2011, Edward DeMarco. The game. Atlanta Braves 2, Washington Nationals nothing at Nationals Park in Washington, D.C. The attendance 39,055 on Thursday, March 31st, 2011. The weather, 40s and drizzly. Hall of Famers, Braves third baseman Chipper Jones and Nationals catcher Ivan Rodriguez. Future Hall of Famers, maybe Braves first baseman Freddie Freeman, who will be eligible 5 years after retirement. Game highlights. After enduring five last-place finishes in six seasons since baseball's return to Washington, ever-hopeful Nationals fans were starting to see a light at the end of the tunnel by opening day 2011. All those bad seasons led to good draft picks who were blossoming into promising players. Jordan Zimmerman, Drew Storen, Danny Espinosa, and others. Phenom Steven Strasburg exploded onto the big league stage with a stunning 14-strikeout performance in his June 2010 debut. But after just 12 starts, he faced season-ending elbow surgery that would cause him to miss most of 2011, while 18-year-old Bryce Harper would spend 2011 seasoning in the minor leagues. High-profile free agents were taking notice, though, and Washington was paying accordingly, inking free agent right fielder Jason Wirth to a 7-year, $121 million contract, at the time one of the biggest in history. Still, that light at the end of the tunnel was dim on opening day as expectations for 2011 were muted. The cold and miserable weather matched Washington's offensive output, spoiling a decent pitching performance by 36-year-old starter Levon Hernandez and four relievers. Brian McCann singled home Chipper Jones in the first, and Jason Hayward homered in the second for the game's only runs. The story. No matter the city, opening day is the one time each regular season when you can count on local celebs and VIPs to be at the ballpark. In the nation's capital, that includes politicians, lobbyists, bureaucrats, agency heads, and national news anchors, among others. Most are casual fans who attend only a few games each season. Many are seeking to influence, or be influenced, or just plain under the influence. A few are well-known and recognizable. Most are not. For example, Edward DeMarco, a diehard Nationals fan and partial season ticket holder from the day the team arrived in Washington, is a familiar face only to his friends, family, and regular viewers of C-SPAN 3. Mr. DeMarco was a conscientious career civil servant and one of the country's leading experts on the mortgage industry and housing policy. A calm, knowledgeable, level-headed, nonpartisan agency head is a rare breed in Washington, but was so necessary to help lead the country out of the 2008 housing crisis. In 2009, he was entrusted by President Obama to head the Federal Housing Finance Agency. On March 31st, 2011, opening day, Mr. DeMarco was summoned to testify before the U.S. House of Representatives Financial Services Subcommittee on Capital Markets, Insurance, and Government-Sponsored Enterprises, or GSEs, to report on the financial condition of the housing GSEs Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, something he frequently was called upon to do. As conservator of Fannie and Freddie, his agency was responsible for assisting troubled homeowners while minimizing further calls on taxpayers who had already bailed out mortgage securities holders at a cost well in excess of $100 billion. The hearing was scheduled to begin at 10 a.m. and last 2.5 hours. It would be tight, but with first pitch slated for 1:10 p.m., DeMarco thought he might make it on time. At 12:30 p.m., with the interrogation of DeMarco now complete, California Republican Gary Miller, who already had exceeded his allotted time, asked Committee Chair Scott Garrett of New Jersey for an additional minute. Anxious to leave, DeMarco politely held his position at the witness table. Miller simply wanted to publicly wish his political rival, Massachusetts Democrat, and the committee's ranking member, Barney Frank, a happy 71st birthday. After bipartisan applause, but before the chair could draw the hearing to a close, it was Frank's turn to further extend the proceedings. First pitch was slipping away. DeMarco's foot was nervously tapping a gym bag under the table. It contained his Nationals jersey and other game day gear. Mr. Chairman, if you would yield briefly, Frank asked.
I will yield, yes, Garrett replied.
I would just like to add, Frank continued, Mr. DeMarco's testimony was exactly what we need from witnesses. It was responsive, it was aimed at helping us legislate, and I not only want to express my appreciation, but I hope other people will follow his example.
After accepting hearty congratulations from his most excellent performance on the hot seat, DeMarco quickly packed his papers, reached under the table to fetch that gym bag, and scurried down the hall to the men's room to shed the suit and tie. A meticulous planner, he had wisely packed the layers needed to survive what promised to be a frigid opening day. A car was waiting just outside the Rayburn House office building, and the driver followed DeMarco's instructions exactly.
Nationals Park, please, quickly.
The trip was a little over a mile straight down South Capitol Street. At 12:50 p.m., DeMarco hopped out of the Chrysler's back seat and sprinted to the center field entrance and then through a metal detector. Without a presidential first pitch, security was lighter than years past. He went straight to the nearby Red Porch Bar, where a cold beer was waiting. After a stress-filled 3 hours, it was the least I could do for my brother-in-law.
Eddie, baby! I exclaimed. Ordy, baby! Came the customary response.
His wife, Garland, and sister, Kate, my wife, joined the festivities. Minutes later, Livan Hernandez's first pitch to Jason Hayward, a call strike. Another opening day was underway. Ed and I became friends during the summer of 1978 between high school and college. We were the real-life odd couple, my Oscar Madison to his Felix Unger. Best friends living in different worlds. He graduated from Notre Dame in 3.5 years before earning his master's and PhD in economics. I had to take 9 credits during summer school in 1981 to barely graduate on time. When he was in the library on Friday or Saturday nights, I could usually be found at a game or social event clinging to a fake ID. And while he was circulating in the highest levels of economic thought and academia, I was hanging out in stadiums and arenas. Our respective journeys to the Nationals were quite different, too. But once the team landed in 2005, we were kindred spirits. He spent his early childhood in New England, growing up a Red Sox fan. He wound up at Notre Dame in part because Carl Yastrzemski went there. Of course, I grew up a Washington Senators fan. One of our fondest Nationals memories is from September 23, 2007, the last ever Nationals game at RFK. The team was planning a lower-key pregame ceremony compared to what we experienced upon baseball's historic return in April 2005. It promised to be a more upbeat farewell than the one in 1971. We'd heard it would involve a few local Senators alumni, including my hero, Frank Hondo Howard. On the way to the ballpark, I got a call from Tom Ward, head of sales and marketing for the Nationals. The team was planning a post-game ceremony, and he was in search of a last-minute willing participant. Each player would give a lucky fan or sponsor the jersey off their back. Since someone had canceled, my company was a sponsor, and no one else was able to make it on such short notice, Tom offered the spot to me. I asked if I could re-gift the opportunity to someone who was an even more invested fan than I was. He agreed to allow Ed to participate. The ceremonies, pregame and post, were a weak attempt to replicate what the Orioles had done so masterfully in 1991 for the final game at Memorial Stadium. See Chapter 1993 in the story about my son Brad. But unlike Baltimore, Washington didn't have 37 continuous years of baseball memories to draw from, or 3 World Series titles. It was still a thrill to see Hondo limp out to third base and greet his successor as the face of D.C. baseball, Ryan Zimmerman, and to see Dick Bosman throw one more pitch from the RFK mound. After the Nats beat the Phillies, and while they uprooted home plate to ship it off to the new ballpark, players lined up along the third base line, unbuttoning their jerseys. Eager fans lined up along first. Ed stood near the end of the line, while our families huddled in the stands near home plate. We started counting off players, hoping to figure out whose jersey might find its way to the DeMarco home. Standing at only 5'5",
whatever jersey Ed got would be too big. At an even 6 feet, All-Star closer Chad Cordero's would come closest. One by one, each player handed his jersey to an adoring fan and then headed to the locker room. As the lines got shorter, we couldn't control our laughter. Ed was about to meet Nationals pitcher John Rausch. At 6'11", Rausch was the tallest player in Major League Baseball history. Hecklers, especially his family, encouraged Ed to immediately don the Giants jersey. Unwilling to be humiliated on the field, Ed earnestly thanked Rausch for a great season. His 88 relief appearances in 2007 led the National League. Both smiled and walked away. Once outside the stadium, we insisted Ed try it on. Seeing him in that jersey conjured up memories of the summer of 1969 and the Frank Howard jersey experience I described in Chapter 1976 and included in the 2005 letter to the editor of the Washington Post. Just as Hondo's once fit me, so too did John's fit Ed. It was bigger than he was. Over the past 40 years, we've enjoyed countless family events, holidays, weddings, funerals, graduations, and reunions. The Nats always provided that special escape from everything else, especially during our annual trips to spring training. Oftentimes, we'd be at the same Nationals game but not sitting together, yet we'd still find a way to connect, especially on opening day. For the box score, play-by-play, Ed in that ginormous jersey, and the two faces of D.C. baseball, Frank Howard and Ryan Zimmerman together, visit openingday5050.com.